From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. We're going now to Manhattan's Lower East Side, where it's common to encounter strong feelings, in this case, strong feelings about pickles. Sarah Reynolds has this profile of one man in the pickle business.
Every Tuesday, a truck pulls up to Alan Kaufman's Pickle Emporium, the Pickle Guys, and drops off thousands of cucumbers. He pours about 2,000 of them into a barrel to start.
We got a last box going in now.
Tuesday is pickling day. Okay. Kaufman opened his shop in 2000 in a neighborhood fondly known as the Old Pickle District. He learned to pickle with some of the old-timers before opening his own place.
This is salt brine. The amount of time that they sit in the barrels will determine what kind of pickles they're going to be.
According to the New York Food Museum, pickling was a booming business in the early 1900s.
What's up? What can I get for you?
For decades, there were about 200 pickle shops in the area. Today, there are very few.
Hot sour, hot half sour?
Hot sour.
Pickles are very important to some people. Some people get very irate if the pickle's not just perfect. They're either too sour or not sour enough. I want them straight, I don't want them crooked. People are very fussy when it comes to their pickles.
Hot enough?
Kaufman is a jolly 50 years old, with a neatly trimmed beard and a shirt with a talking pickle that says, "Smells great, tastes better." His shop is filled with neat rows of dark red open barrels, all full of pickles.
Okay, we sell sour pickles, three-quarter sour pickles, half sour pickles, new pickles, hot sour pickles, hot half sour pickles, and horseradish pickles. And that's just the pickles we sell.
Pickling is a delicate matter. Customers and picklers alike have their tendencies, and they're stubborn about them. Nancy Ralph, director of the New York Food Museum, also sees the pickler in the pickle.
It's an improvisational art, so people experiment with different flavors and come up with their favorite flavors. It sort of matches their own taste or the market they're trying to reach.
Hot sour, hot half sour, horseradish.
And as a consequence, it takes on sort of the personality of the owner. So people create a product that tastes like who they are.
Well, you like hot stuff, these are hot.
Alan Kaufman has rules, but they're simple. Don't put your hands in the barrels. He'll get the pickles for you with a big silver bowl.
I love it. Give me one more.
No napkins. Use your sleeves. You get a pickle to eat while you wait, and you'll like it. People seem to find the rules entertaining and come back for more. Len Zerling comes in to buy pickles for his mother. He loves the smell of the place.
Sweet, sour, brine, salt. What good is a steak or a hot dog without pickles? Everybody has their own taste. I like half sours. My mother loves sours.
Kaufman hands him a pickle.
You want a bite?
Kaufman says that a good sandwich is only a good sandwich without a really great pickle. And he knows he's right. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Reynolds in New York.
Perhaps he'll introduce an Icelandic version of McDonald's apple pie. But if not, John Ogmundson and you should check out our website, npr.org, where cookbook author Nancy Baggett puts 16 different apples through the kitchen inferno.
If you look at the apple before it's baked, It is, in fact, a Macintosh. And the problem is it falls apart.
I would think that was an enchilada, actually, if you didn't tell me it was
Vesuvius.
An apple.
Yes, Mount Vesuvius.
Butter, cinnamon, brown sugar, and baked apples. What could go wrong? Find out at npr.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Remember those days when shrimp cocktails were so skimpy and you'd only get 5 or 6 in a glass? Well, now you can enjoy as many shrimp as you want.
Endless shrimp at Red Lobster, the only time of year to enjoy all the...
The U.S. now consumes more shrimp per capita than any other seafood. But about 90% of that shrimp comes from farms overseas. So how do American shrimpers stay in business? Weekend Edition producer Thomas Pierce joins us. He recently returned from a trip on a shrimp boat off the coast of South Carolina. Hi there, Thomas.
Hi, Jackie.
You know, how much shrimp are we talking about? How much is the American market compared to everything else?
The American market is pretty small compared to the what we're bringing in imports. We brought in about 1.2 billion pounds of shrimp last year, and the American market's just a quarter of that. So even if you're living down in the Gulf, if you order those shrimp and grits, you're probably going to find imported shrimp on the plate.
So it's got to be a pretty hard way to make a living.
It's pretty hard. They're not making nearly as much money as they used to. And look, I'm from South Carolina, and I was pretty interested in this. So I went down to Shem Creek, which is Charleston, South Carolina, and it's a longtime hub for shrimpers, to see who's left and how they're making it. And that's where I met Wayne Magwood. He's the owner of a market there. It's been open for 40 years. He calls himself the public relations officer for South Carolina Shrimp. And he took me out on his trawler, The Winds of Fortune.
Hey, good morning, Captain. We think your ETA to the Cooper Bridges.
So, it's 5 a.m., and we've just left the dock. Wayne Magwood leans back in his captain's chair, radio in his hand. He's wearing two flannel shirts because it's chilly out this morning. There's salt on the windows, and that obscures what is already a dark view, tiny lights twinkling out ahead.
That's my brother's boat he just left up there.
He navigates in the dark, chatting with other captains on the radio about the temperature, the size of the waves, and yesterday's rain.
My damn brain jacket filled up with water with my phone in it. She went bloop, 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 and that was it.
They also talk about where they might go today, north or south along the coast of Charleston.
In the old days, they didn't share information much. You know, it was kind of cutthroat. Everybody was out for themselves. But now there's not many of us left, so we pretty well work together.
Wayne knows about the old days. He's a third-generation shrimper.
Been on shrimp boat all my life, since I was 4 years old. Me and my brother and my dad. And then when I graduated from high school, we started running the boats. My brother and I, we take turns being captain. Eventually, my dad bought another boat. And so my brother had one, I had one, and he bought another one. Dad had one, two brothers, and then my little brother came along and he bought another one.
Basically, every male Magwood had a boat back then. Up until the late 80s, you might have seen 60 shrimp trawlers operating out of Shem Creek. Today, he says there are more like six. We're north of Charleston now, just 3 miles offshore. The sun's still not up, but it's time to put out the nets. The crew works in silence, cigarettes dangling from their lips as they use a giant winch to lower 45-foot outriggers on either side of the boat. There's 29-year-old Vinny Vieira, 18-year-old Vasa Tarvi, and John Zillman, the newest crew member. He's 36. They swing two ancient-looking doors out over the water.
Those are called the otter boards, and it rides right on the bottom and it spreads the net open. This chain in front of the net is called a tickler chain. Like, it tickles the shrimp, I guess, makes them jump up off the bottom, out the mud, and into the net.
What happens next happens fast. A line pops, and one of the otter boards falls into the waves. The crew scrambles to fix the problem. John Zillman accidentally steps back into the net as it's going over the side of the boat. A chain tightens around his ankle, nearly dragging him over the side. Vinny and Vasa hold on to him, squeezing his foot out of his boot.
Get out! Get your foot out of there!
Once he's out, he sits to massage his ankle.
Did it hurt your ankle?
No, I'm good.
Could have carried you over the side.
They fix the line and get the nets out, all 120 feet of them. The crew then files back into the deckhouse to make eggs and grits on a small stove. Their plates slide as they eat in a cloud of cigarette smoke. Then they watch some of a movie, Hellboy 2, before passing out in bunks, boots still on their feet. The next 3 hours are a waiting game. Wayne can't help but recall their best days.
One day, I think it was about 5 years ago, they opened shrimp season and the shrimp were big. First day, we caught 9,000 pounds. And they were all big shrimp. Boat made $27,000 that one day. That was the best haul we ever made. Beautiful, beautiful day.
Yesterday, he caught more like 600 pounds of large and medium-sized white shrimp, which brought in about $1,500. That gets divided among the boat crew and the dock crew, minus the cost of fuel. It's not that white shrimp population is down from 5 years ago. In fact, according to the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources, if anything, there might be more now because of the milder winters. It boils down to being in the right place at the right time. And as for today, we find out 3 hours later. Sea life spills onto the deck, a huge pile heaving like a beating heart. Stingrays, flounder, a baby shark, croakers, minnows, and of course, shrimp.
Not as pretty as I wanted to be, but it's at least 200 pounds, big ones, maybe 250 pounds. Big ones.
Now comes the job of sorting through it all. The guys sit on small stools picking out the shrimp, which go in buckets. The rest of it, some of it alive and some not, gets swept overboard. A free meal for the seagulls and porpoises that follow the boat like band groupies. Vinny Vieira is Wayne Magwood's stepson, and he's been shrimping for 11 years now, 6 days a week.
You make good money at it sometimes.
You
make good money sometimes?
Yeah. Some years are better than other years, but, you know, we make a living doing it. We ain't put four kids through college, and I got two children myself, so, I mean, we're surviving, you know?
Each crew member gets a 10% cut, he says, and that translates to anywhere between $15,000 and $30,000 a year.
Either ignorant or stubborn, I don't know which. We're just hoping it'll turn around if we can hang there long enough. The price will go up with everything being going local. Most of your shrimpers are selling to restaurants.
Wayne advertises a list of the Charleston restaurants that serve his shrimp on a chalkboard back at his market. These restaurants, he says, help keep shrimpers in business, and promoting those relationships is the job of the South Carolina Shrimpers Association. Wayne Magwood is the president of the organization this year.
Shrimpers had a bad rap, bad PR, so we try to do some good PR, you know, get out to the public that we're not raping the ocean, we're just out there to make a living, trying to provide a resource for the community.
Part of Wayne's PR strategy means taking people out on his boat, from school kids and community leaders to people like Jim Cantore from the Weather Channel and Mike Rowe from the Discovery Channel show Dirty Jobs. He'll take anyone if it helps get the word out about ocean-caught shrimp.
Yeah, I think the word's getting out. It's slow, but it's getting out there. Hopefully it'll get out and we'll be able to survive. And hopefully we get some young blood in this industry because not many of us left.
And that's our producer, Thomas Pierce, with that story. And he joins me in the studio now. Thomas, I love this. You've got a bumper sticker that says, "Friends don't let friends eat imported shrimp."
I do. These have been around for a couple of years. They're not just in South Carolina, but you do see them on bumpers all over the state. The South Carolina Shrimpers Association hand these out, and it kind of encapsulates this marketing campaign they've got going on.
Does it work?
Captain Magwood says he's noticed improvement. When we got back to the dock, there were, in fact, a couple of regular customers waiting with empty coolers. I will add, though, that Captain Magwood is doing better than many others because he's been around for a long time and he's got this market. Most shrimpers don't have their own markets. He's got deep ties to this area. So he even remarked that if things get even worse, he could be the last one standing.
Well, you can see a photo gallery of a day on the Winds of Fortune shrimp trawler by coming to NPR.org. And Thomas, thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Jackie.
As you know, the days are getting shorter and darker and colder. It's the time of year when winter begins to creep in and also the time of year when we look for things to make us feel a little more warm and comfortable. One of the best ways to do that is through a little dose of self-indulgence. The food writer and Morning Edition regular Nigella Lawson has some thoughts about self-indulgence. She joins us from London to talk about them. Hi, Nigella.
Hello. I'm very, very pro-self-indulgence. I'll be up front now.
I had a feeling you might be, although we should emphasize that in the United States, self-indulgence, I mean, kind of got that Puritan heritage over here. It's considered bad.
It is considered bad. And in a way, you could say that only heightens the pleasure. So your negativity is not entirely negative, we should say. I mean, I think that we feel that self-indulgence is bad for two reasons. I think one, that people are kind of diet obsessed. And the other, of course, as you say, it's a puritanical feeling that somehow if you enjoy yourself, there must be some moral slackness.
Well, let's just dive into some moral slackness here, if we might. Because once again, our colleague, Courtney Dorning, has baked one of your recipes here. And just at first glance, it looks like a cross between a pancake and a toasted cheese sandwich. I believe it's called donut French toast. What is it?
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. It's the right sort of color.
Oh, my God.
Really,
it's amazing.
It's really...
Excuse me, this is just amazing. It's like a donut, but it's French toast. But go on, please.
Yeah,
please.
No, well, I think the reason why I think of it as a sort of donut is because the egginess and the vanilla come through, and then you put sugar on top, like a donut. And there's something, I don't know whether this is true, but someone once said to me that vanillin, which is the thing that makes vanilla smell like it does, is present in breast milk. So we have some very primitive desire to be comforted by the taste of vanilla. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm just telling you. So you could say it's a kind of Freudian self-indulgence.
I had a mouthful of it when you were saying that. It's really more than I needed to know. But thank you anyway. I appreciate it. It does taste like it's got almost like a donut glaze on it. It really is quite a treat. It's really great.
Well, sugar, you know, sugar is enormously comforting. And I say that as someone who finds all food comforting, including savory foods.
So how do you find a balance, or do you even try, between enjoying something a little rich from time to time and actually, you know, going overboard and being unhealthy?
Well, I think the balance is much easier to maintain if you don't deny yourself all the time. I think people who forbid themselves to eat anything that's been fried or that has butter are the ones that suddenly manage to eat tubs and tubs of ice cream. Mm. Whereas I think the body is self-regulating. There are times when you want something fried and then you feel like a very light soup or a plate of steamed vegetables. I mean, I actually feel I eat very healthily. My only problem is I eat enough for five healthy people. That's it's a portion control issue. But I do think it is okay to eat foods that the dietitians say don't eat. I also think that one should make a real distinction between self-indulgent foods that are real foods and processed foods which have all sorts of things in them which aren't good for you. So as long as you're cooking proper food for yourself, I don't think you need to feel so bad about it.
Well, that's interesting. It sounds a little like Michael Pollan, who's been in this program many times, talking
yes.
about, you know, something that feels natural, something that your grandmother would recognize as a food rather than a food product of some kind.
No, I think that's he's quite right there.
Now, you've also got, if you don't mind, I'm going to eat the other piece of this donut French toast.
Carry on, crunching.
And as I do that, yes, it does have a crunch to it. It's really really crispy. It's great. I wonder if you could describe another recipe you've got here. I don't know if this would go with a donut French toast, but if you would describe the cheddar cheese risotto, please.
I would be delighted to. I don't think it does go with it, but I think it has a lot in common, even though, of course, the ingredients are very, very different, which is, I suppose, self-indulgent foods are reminiscent of the tastes we loved in childhood. So just like the eggs and the milk and the sugar in the donut French toast, the cheese risotto, the cheese melts and becomes sort of gooey. So I suppose it's like a slightly grown-up grilled cheese sandwich, but there's something about carbohydrate which you cannot beat carbohydrate for comfort. And even though I at first felt I felt bad about, you know, the Italians and why am I putting cheddar in a risotto, but an Italian friend of mine says that whenever she goes back to Italy, they ask her to bring cheddar back because, of course, for them, they make a choice between cheese that has a flavour or cheese that goes gooey. Now, cheddar has a strong flavour and also goes gooey, so it's kind of perfect.
Mm, but not something that would be on a traditional Italian plate.
Oh, not at all. But I think that my notion of self-indulgence perhaps isn't entirely the same as everyone else's. And what I love about this dish is you can sneak a few minutes in the kitchen and just stir. And sometimes I find that the best way to switch off. So I'm really in my own little world stirring something and then I'm eating it. I do think also anything that can be eaten out of a bowl with a spoon is a fantastic self-indulgence. No cutting, no chewing.
Mm, there you go. Excuse me, I was just chewing some more of the donut French toast there. Is there anything to avoid when you're putting together some self-indulgent food like this?
Well, I'm afraid there probably are things you should avoid, but I don't know that I know how to. I suppose you don't want to have them every day. You don't want it to be a pile-up. And also, I think sometimes people confuse comfort eating with misery. So there is no point in indulging yourself if you're going to persecute yourself at the same time. That is what you have to avoid.
What do you mean?
If you don't enjoy it because you think I shouldn't be eating this, then don't. If you can wallow in the pleasure of every single mouthful, then you're doing something good. And then I think then somehow it's healthier. No, it's not healthier. It doesn't make any difference nutritionally. But I think the mind is important as well as the body.
Nigella Lawson, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Nigella Lawson is the author of several cookbooks, including most recently Nigella Christmas. And if you'd like to indulge yourself at home, both of these recipes are on our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.